We'll start again with a piece of Rabbeinu Bechaya from the coming week's parasha. And Rabbeinu Bechaya, as you've seen already in his opening essay, is very loosely connected to the parasha. It's sometimes quite a mystery to figure out even why he opens the parasha with that particular essay. He starts with a pasuk from Mishle usually, and then he develops the pasuk, and then he links it into the parasha. This week, I'm particularly interested in the first paragraph of his opening essay because of how important it is. And the pasuk that he uses from Mishle chapter 15 is Simcha la'ish b'ma'an efiv v'davar b'ito matov. It's a pleasure, it's a joy for a person when he answers with his mouth, when he expresses himself with his mouth. And something at the right time, a word at the right time, how good is it? So Rabbeinu Bechaya begins to talk and he says, Shlomo HaMelech Alav HaShalom Hodiyanu B'Katuv HaZeh. Shlomo HaMelech teaches us in this one posuk, Ki Ha'ish B'Diburo K'Shuhu Medaber Dvarov B'Chochma. When a person speaks his words with wisdom, which doesn't happen all that often, Yesh lo simcha al zeh, it is a source of joy to the speaker, not just to the person who hears it. But when it comes out right, when you've said something that is wise, it's a source of joy. Lefisha hadibur hu mitzad hasechel, because speech comes from intellect, besibat hanefesh hasichlit, and it comes from that part of the human soul that is the intellectual part. That's the piece that's different from any other being. So when are we expressing our humanity at the most is when we articulate an idea in words. That's something that no people say, can animals communicate, can they not communicate? That's not what we mean by speech. Communicating, sure, animals can communicate, plants can communicate, insects can communicate. That's not the issue. The issue is, can they conceptualize? Can they take a concept and name the concept and express it in a way that another person can understand, that no other being can do? So when we're doing that, we're at our most human. There's nothing that we do that is as human as when we articulate an idea in words. And that's why dibur, speech, is referred to and connected to Hashem himself. As it says, Borein nivs v'sayim, Hashem, the creator of the expression of words. And the Novi brings many examples of that. When a person is intentional, and his choice of words here are amazing, he's intentional to express words that are nechochim. The word nechochim means present. Do you know how often people say things and there's no presence in the comment? It just doesn't fit. It doesn't, and the person isn't really there. It's just words. Umesukonim, and they're carefully chosen. Umesader oisom bechochmas haseichel, and he sorts them out in his mind. He actually prepares what he's going to say. Then yismach al zeh. Then it's a source of joy when he gets the words out and they're right. Because he didn't express himself until he thought about it. So to think about an idea, to compose the idea, to articulate the idea in a way that somebody else can understand it, that's creative. There's hardly anything as creative that a human being can do as to create a sentence. To take sounds and convert them into letters and words and syllables that create a sentence that expresses an idea which can be completely original, can be something that nobody in the world has ever heard before. That's what is there more creative? Everything else is just a kind of combinations of that and outcomes of that. But the most creative thing that we do is to create an idea and express it, and that's a source of great joy. You know that when you're preparing what you're going to say. I mean, even this idea of preparing what you're going to say, how many times do you find people getting up and giving speeches that are unprepared? Say, you ever heard that? Giving a Dvar Torah that is unprepared, giving a drosha that is unprepared. And Rabbeinu Bechaya says, just the idea of preparing, that you know that you've prepared, and that is biyad adam, that's a human being. You can't blame Hashem for an unprepared speech. You didn't prepare your speech, that's your business. Hashem doesn't prepare your speech for you, you've got to do the preparation. Veloke in hadibur, but the way it comes out of your mouth is not you. Ki hadibur yovo me'ez Hashem. Dibur, the actual speech, that comes from Hashem. And that's why people who are familiar with it and well-schooled in public speaking will often say, don't write a script. Don't script your words. Because, well, using Rabbeinu Bechaya's angle on it, because if you script it, you're not giving Hashem a chance. Then it's only you. So you've got to do your bit. You've got to be well-prepared. You've got to know your subject. You've got to have prepared what you're going to say. You've got to have prepared how you're going to present it. All of that you've got to do. But when you've done a lot of preparation and you get up to speak, then you let it come naturally. And it will very often come not quite as you prepared it, and you'll think of something you didn't think of while you were preparing, and you'll decide maybe not to say something you had prepared, but you decided. In the moment, there's enormous creativity that comes in the moment, and this is not just Dibur, it's any form of creativity. A pianist sits down at the piano, they've got to be incredibly well prepared. They've got to know it. I heard a pianist talking a few months ago, and she was just saying that by the time she sits at the piano, it's not the musician's music anymore. It's come through her. This is coming from deep inside her. And that ability to have an idea and absorb the idea completely, that you've prepared it so well that you can now allow yourself to speak freely, so that what comes out is then that's influenced by Hashem. I'm sure you've had the experience, as I have every day, that sometimes you say something and it lands well, and it's different from what you prepared, and it just was the right thing. It was the right tone. It was the right thing that an individual or a group of individuals needed to hear at that particular moment. And that says the Rabbeinu Bechaya, that's not the preparation. Ki adibur yovo me'ez Hashem, because the actual, when it comes to actually saying it, that comes from Hashem. P'chinyan shekosuv la'adam ma'archei lev u'me'Hashem ane lashon. We say on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur in the davening that the human being, and we relate this to prayer, to davening, the human being lays out his heart, but Hashem pronounces it on the lips. Rabbeinu Bechaya says that's not just about davening, that's every idea. You can prepare the idea, you've got to do all the preparation you can, and then you've got to allow it to come naturally, you've got to allow it to come intuitively from you, and leave it to Hashem. You've got to allow Hashem to be able to do his magic and bring out the right words in the most spectacular way. And when a person has put a lot of intentionality into the composition of his words, and it came out right, because you never know for sure. There's always that. People often ask me, am I still nervous when I stand up and speak? And I do it, I don't know how many times a week, and have done for so many years. And yes, it's completely nervous because I'm not reading from a script. So every time there's that gap between, okay, I've prepared, but who knows what I'm actually going to say? You actually don't know what you're actually going to say. You leave it to Hashem to guide you, and you don't know, and that's a scary moment. So yes, you're absolutely nervous unless you're reading from a script. It was interesting, if you remember right after 9/11, in the first interactions after 9/11, President Bush was very unconvincing and very hesitant and didn't hit the mark at all, and then all of a sudden it was different. And the difference was he went off script. That he felt that it wasn't him story. They had prepared his things, and it was a very sensitive situation, obviously, and they had prepared exactly what he had to say, and he said what he was told to say, until he realized, this isn't me talking. I can't say somebody else's words. This isn't me talking. And so it is with all of us. We can and have to prepare everything we say. Nothing should come out without some level of preparation. But when it comes out just right, then you've got a situation. Then you realize Hashem is helping you. Hashem is by your side. When something comes out just right, and even though you prepared it, the way it comes out is not exactly as you prepared it, you know Hashem is with you. That's that's the piece. I was very excited to hear this because a lot of the non-Jewish people who work with me tell me that they find like that there's a moment when I'm working with a group of people that the words they use, there's a moment when Hashem walks into the room and you can feel it. And it's like that whenever we're speaking. We don't notice it. We're not sensitive enough to it. When it just, somebody gets it. You see somebody's eyes light up. They get it. You know, you make a point and the other person gets it. And you suggest something and the other person accepts it. When it just works right, one has to be able to feel that this is Hashem working with you. This is a partnership. This is not something one can do on one's own. It is like this with Dibur, but it's like this in every field of expertise. You've got to be as expert as you can be, but then you're sitting. And whether you're a psychologist working with a client, or you're a surgeon working on a patient, or you're a lawyer working with it doesn't really matter, or you're in business. Those moments where you've just got to connect right, you've got to be at your best. As much as one prepares for it, and one has to prepare for it, that connection that takes place, that's divine. That's not something that happens naturally. Zeu Shama, this is what Shlomo HaMelech means when he says, Simcha le'ish b'ma'anefiv. There's a joy in the human being when he expresses himself correctly, accurately. He goes into another piece. I don't want to take time reading it through, but his second piece is the importance of timing. That you have to be careful to say not what's on your mind, but what's appropriate. And that things are not, what you want to say is not always, it's not always the right time to say it. And you have to be able to hold it back and not say it just because the time is not right. It's just not appropriate. And he brings the Gemara that we use so often, Shalim Hilchas Pesach Befesach V'Hilchas Atzeres Ba'atzeres V'Hilchas Achag B'Chag. One has to study the laws of Pesach at Pesach time, and the laws of Shavuos at Shavuos time, and the laws of Sukkos at Sukkos time. And the Gemara says also like 30 days before the Yom Tov, you start learning and teaching the laws of each Yom Tov. And I always understand it, as most people do, that it comes to tell you before Yom Tov, you must learn the laws. Even though you know them from before Yom Tov, you must learn the laws. Rabbeinu Bechaya says it's something else. That's what you talk about before that Yom Tov, and not something else. Before Pesach, you don't talk about Shavuos, even if that's what's on your mind, and you might be studying it. Before Pesach, you talk about Pesach. Before Shavuos, you talk about Shavuos. It's like rabbis will always talk about the parasha. You've got to link what you're saying to somebody or to a group of people to the time that you're at. The way you talk, he says further on, the way you talk in a shiva house and the way you talk at a simcha, two different ways of talking. You have to be sensitive to what's happening around you. That's part of the art of conversation, the art of self-expression, the art of public speaking, whatever form of communication it is that we're using. Those are then the three criteria. You've got to be really well prepared. You've got to allow yourself to flow so that Hashem can play a part in it. And it's got to be the right thing at the right time in the right place. It's got to be appropriate. And those are the three. When those three come together, it's a source of great simcha. It's a source of great joy, and one can feel it. Good. Now we'll tackle some very difficult gemara. But we will unpack it carefully and slowly, and we'll... So you need to have three texts in front of you. If you have from last week, that's good. If not, I've printed out some more. You need to have the piece of Gemara we're on, which is Daf Chaf Amud Beis. And you need to have another piece of Gemara, which is Daf Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph. And the third thing is you need to have the Tosfos, which you have on Chof Amud Beis, you have the Tosfos, but I also printed the Tosfos out in blocked letters so that it might be easier to follow. I broke it into three paragraphs that we'll learn, so you can use that one as well as we get to it. And remember from the introduction at the beginning of the whole series, when we learn Gemara, it's not about the content. The content is valuable, the content is important, of course, and all our halachic decisions come from the Gemara. Our understanding of the Torah comes from the Gemara, our understanding of everything comes from the Gemara. But what I wanted to focus on in this group mainly was the methodology. Rather than the content of the Gemara, the methodology of thinking, particularly in the area of resolving doubt and dealing in areas of doubt and trying to live with certainty in a world of uncertainty is what we're dealing with. And we start on the Chaf, so I'm going to go over what we did last time and then get straight into the Tosfos. So it's about five or six lines from the top of the page. Omer Rabbi Akiva, ani lo bati lidei midazu, ela kol shiyadua. This goes back to the previous Amud, where we had three views. We had the view of Rabbi Yishmael, and this was about the whole question of an animal that is 2 years old, or 3 years old, or 1 year old, and has it had a calf before, or hasn't it, the various assumptions we can make. And Rabbi Yishmael focused on the age. Kishenemru, we said in the previous Amud, Kishenemru Dvorim Lifnei Rabbi Yeshua, when Rabbi Yeshua heard this, Omalehen Su Imrolo Rabbi Yishmael, go and tell Rabbi Yishmael, Taisa, you're mistaken, because there are also possibilities of miscarriages. An animal doesn't become a non-bechor-bearing animal only if it's already had a calf before. An animal can become a non-bechor-bearing animal if it had a miscarriage before. And what farmer can be sure that there hasn't been a miscarriage? How would you even know? And he describes what the various miscarriages are, and it's very possible the farmer wouldn't even be aware. So you're always in doubt. Even if you know that this animal hasn't given birth before, you don't know it hasn't had a miscarriage before, so it's always in doubt. And then Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, the third view, Ani lo basi lidei midazu, I didn't even get involved in this, ela kol shiyadua shibicha, if you know for sure that there's been an animal born, you saw it, you were aware, then the next animal is not a bechor, and the kohen has nothing. And if you know for sure it hasn't had a previous birth or miscarriage, then the animal belongs to the kohen totally. But in most cases, you're in doubt, and if you're in doubt, then the animal has to be retained until it gets a mum, and when it gets a mum, it gets a blemish, then it can be shechted. So we're exploring the difference between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua. Now, I'm not going to go into the wording of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua that carefully right now, because that in itself is a long conversation. Suffice it to say that Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua are saying something very similar. They're very, very close. And yet they're clearly not saying the same thing. So one of the important skills in learning is, or two of the important skills in learning and in life, the one is to be able to notice when two things that look the same aren't the same. That's the one thing. When two views, two opinions, two ideas sound very similar, to be able to differentiate them, pull them apart and say they look the same, they're not the same. Here's where they differ. And in an equal measure, it's the skill is to be able to take two things that look very different and find, you know, the principle that underpins both of these is the same. This is just different sides of the same coin. So to be able to see difference where there appears to be no difference, and to see similarity and unison where there seems to be two completely different ideas, are two important ideas in learning. And we'll see in this piece of Gemara both of those playing out. The one is Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua seem to be very similar. So the Gemara asks, just after the two dots, Mai Ika ben Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua, what really is the difference between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yeshua? Now, in Halacha and in Gemara, when we ask about a difference, the best way to understand the difference is to look at halachic implication. if two people were to say something that where the halachic implication is identical, then you don't have to worry so much, are they saying the same thing or they're not saying the same thing. One of the ways you explore the similarity or difference between two ideas is to extrapolate the halachic outcome. That's where it's easier to see the difference. It's like if you can imagine two rockets are fired and they're a fraction of a degree in different directions. They're just, one is fired true north and whatever degree, and one is just a fraction off that measurement. And you might find it very different to notice that they're different, but a few hundred thousand miles away, they're going to be very far from one another. So it's like that with ideas. When you look at the idea itself, it's sometimes very difficult to see the difference. When you extrapolate into halakha, then you can sometimes you see vast differences between the ideas, and that's where you can test it, and that's where you can measure it. So, my Ika ben Rabbi Akiva le Rabbi Yeshua, what is the halachic difference between the way Rabbi Akiva articulated his idea and the way Rabbi Yeshua articulated his idea? Omer Rabbi Chanina Misura, Rabbi Chanina from Sura said, Chalav Poiter Ika Benayu. The idea of Chalav Poiter. Chalav Poiter is an idea we'll speak about a lot tonight. Chalav Poiter means, that we spoke about last time, Chalav Poiter is that if an animal is giving milk, you can assume she has already given birth. And therefore, if she gives birth again after that, you know that that is not a bechor. That's Chalav Poiter, the milk frees. The milk creates a ptur, means that the animal is not a bechor. And that's the difference between them. Rabbi Akiva sova Chalav Poiter. Rabbi Akiva says, milk is clear evidence that there's already been a birth. Helech acharov behemus, it doesn't mean that we're absolutely certain, because it is possible that an animal can give milk even if she hasn't given birth. That can happen. But rov behemus, the majority of animals don't do that. Rov behemus ein cholvis elam ken yoldus. Most animals only give milk if they've had a birth, and we follow the majority, so you can assume. Once again, we're looking at, do we know for sure? No, but we don't know anything for sure. So how do we work with assumptions? We may make an assumption based on the majority that this animal has already had a calf. Rabbi Yeshua says, not so sure. There is a minority of cases where a cow can give milk even though she hasn't had a calf, afapishe in yodas, and therefore we've got to worry about the miut. So just remember that, because we're going to play with it a little bit. So Rabbi Akiva is saying, Chalav Poiter, if the animal's giving milk, we may assume that it's not, the next one's not a bechor. Rabbi Yeshua says we can't make such an assumption, we have to worry about the minority. And you remember we had already Rabbi Meir saying that he doesn't like going after the majority, he's concerned about minorities as well, and that he doesn't just follow majorities. Says the Gemara, Umi Chayish Rabbi Yeshua Lemiut. So that's all fine. In this brisa that we had on the previous page, we had Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Akiva. What's the difference between them? You've suggested a difference. That's okay, but let's test that difference. Does Rabbi Yeshua in all cases say that we are concerned for the minority, for the miut? Is that Rabbi Yeshua's worldview? Vatran, did we not learn? Haitalo chamota eina chosheshet. If a man went overseas with one wife and left another wife back home, and he dies, does the one who was left back home wants to remarry? The question is, does she need chalitza or not? Does she have to? Do we assume that another baby might have been born or not? So we say einach chosheshet. What does that mean? Let's look at the Rashi. If you look at the Rashi, haitala chomata. Can you see that Rashi on the left-hand side, about the level of where we started reading the Gemara? Isha shehalcha hi uvala lemdinat hayam. A woman and her husband went overseas. Umet ba'ala belo banim. And her husband dies having left no children. Ve'ach ein lo, and he has no brother. Ve'yesh la chamota b'mekoma She yatzat misham. But she did leave behind, not another wife. What she did leave behind was a mother-in-law, the girl's mother-in-law, the widow's mother-in-law was left behind. So now what's the possibility? So the man goes overseas with his wife. He dies. His mother is left behind. The wife now wants to remarry. So the wife is now in California, and the mother-in-law is in communist Russia. There's no communication. What is the concern?
The mother could
if
have another.
The mother has had a baby, then the wife needs chalitza. How do you find out? What do we do? Do we let her remarry or don't we? Says Rashi, Einach hosheshat shema nolad ben lechamia. She does not have to worry about whether her mother-in-law has had a child. And that would require to have chalitza. Don't have to worry about that. But yatzah mele'ah chosheshet. If the mother-in-law was pregnant when they left, then you do have to be concerned that she might have had a son. If she had a daughter, there would be no problem. But maybe she had a son, which would mean her late husband now has a brother, a living brother. And you would have to wait for the living brother to grow up and do chalitza. And then she couldn't remarry in the meantime. So that's what the Tanakhama says. Rabbi Yeshua Omer Eina Choshesh. Rabbi Yeshua says, even if when you left the mother-in-law was pregnant, you still don't have to worry. Why? Vamrin and my time at Rabbi Yeshua. What's Rabbi Yeshua's reason? Kasava rov mu'ubarot yoldot. Umiut mapilot. Most pregnant women give birth. The minority have miscarriages. And of those who give birth, 50% are boys, 50% are girls. So if you say, what are the statistical chances? This mother-in-law could have had a boy. Firstly, she could have miscarried or not miscarried. And of the actual birth, 50% are boys, 50% are girls. So what is the chance that she had a boy? Less than 50%. Somewhat less than 50%. Therefore, says Rabbi Yeshua, you don't have to worry, and she can remarry. You don't have to worry about a miut. So says the Gemara, you can't say Rabbi Yeshua is the one who says that we worry that although the cow is giving milk, she might not have had a calf, because the miut, the minority, do. We see that Rabbi Yeshua isn't concerned about minority. So look how carefully the Gemara checks every suggested answer. The Gemara checks. So let's scan through. It's like, you know, going through the hard drive and checking through everything Rabbi Yeshua has ever said. And they find one thing Rabbi Yeshua once said, which isn't consistent with what you're suggesting. And therefore the Gemara says, Ela Epoch. Okay, so switch it around. As we said, Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Akiva, what they said is so close that either one could have said either way. We just know that they weren't saying the same thing. So if you switch it around, now Rabbi Akiva becomes the one who says what?
That you do have to worry whether...
That you do have to worry for the minority?
For the minority fruit, yeah.
And this cow might have had a... Might not. Might, this might be a bechor, even though the cow is giving milk. And Rabbi Yeshua says you don't have to worry about minorities. Vahatanya, and in fact we have a brisa. Now that you mention it, they search through all the archives and they find a forgotten brisa that says Chalav Poter, on the question of Chalav Poter, Divra Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua says milk does free the cow from any suspicion of having a bechor afterwards. Rabbi Akiva Omer Chalav Eina Poter. Exactly as we thought. So we reason it out first and then we find a source for it, and that we put that together, and now we're sure that that's the way to understand it. But it throws us into somewhat of halakhic confusion, because we have two conflicting, several conflicting ideas here. One conflicting idea is when Rabbi Akiva is one of the authorities, we go like Rabbi Akiva. We don't mess with Rabbi Akiva. So the halakh is like Rabbi Akiva. The problem is Rabbi Yeshua was Rabbi Akiva's teacher. And when you have a Talmud and a Rebbe, you that disagree, you follow the Rebbe, not the Talmud. So Rabbi Yeshua is the Rebbe, do we follow Rabbi Yeshua? Rabbi Akiva is Rabbi Akiva, do we follow Rabbi Akiva? So we have two conflicting halakhic issues. So here we're dealing with a double kind of uncertainty. The first uncertainty is, did the cow have a baby or didn't it? Is this animal a bechor or isn't it? That's the one uncertainty we're dealing with. We're dealing with another uncertainty. Is the halakha like Rabbi Akiva? Is the halakha like Rabbi Yeshua? And it's kind of equal. There's good reason to go either way.
Are we going to find another example where they go by the teacher versus the authority figure?
No, we don't. We know that's what you would normally do, barring any other circumstances. We'd always go by the teacher in favor of the as opposed to the Talmud. The and the third factor that factors into all of this is, what do we hold? What do we hold? Do we hold you go after the majority or you don't?
We do.
The
majority.
So who's that? Like Rabbi Akiva or like Rabbi Yeshua? That's like Rabbi Yeshua, so we're going against Rabbi Akiva here. So this is, it's all a little bit confusing, and that's the confusion we'll go into. But in order to get into that confusion, we've got to learn an unrelated piece of Gemara, which appears to be unrelated, but as I explained to you, the hyperlinking system of the Gemara, it all interrelates, and one has to be able to find those relationships. That's the piece from Daf Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph. So I printed out quite a lot of those. There should be enough of Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph.
There's another one here if anyone needs one. Do you have one?
So this starts, six, bless you, about eight lines from the top of the page towards the end of the line, D'Tanya. D'Tanya, because we learnt in a brisa. Halokeach behema menika min ha'ovid kechovin. You buy a cow that is suckling a calf from a non-Jew. So this is not just you find that she's got milk, she's actually suckling a calf. What is the issue?
Is it calf before?
Is the calf a bechor?
Well, at least we know that the next one won't be a bechor.
Can we assume the next one is not a bechor? At least that. Can we assume the next one isn't a bechor? Says the Gemara, Habo achrov bechor misofik. Well, the next one is a sofik. We're not sure about the next one. Bipnei shemerachemet afa pish ena yoledet, because an animal can suckle and love a calf that is not her own. These things happen. An animal can do that. Rabban Shimon Gamaliel Omer Davar Beches Katol. You follow nature. That's not usually what happens. It's natural for that if you see a cow suckling a calf, you're entitled to assume that's its calf. Vechena Yor Rabban Shimon Gamaliel Omer. Rabban Shimon Gamaliel also said, Hanichnas Letoch Edro Belaila. You come into your, in the nighttime, you're busy locking up the pen, and you see there 10 or 15 animals. And half are about to give birth the first time, and half have had animals before. Lemacher hishkim, the next day you go, matzah zacharim tzluyot b'shein mavchirut, and the kevet tzluyot b'mavchirut. You find a strange thing. All the male animals are suckling from the cows that have not had, that have had babies before, so this would not be a bechor. When a kevis tzluyot b'mavchirut, And the female calves are suckling from the animals who are giving birth for the first time. So it would come out, if you go by what you see, that the Kohen has nothing. The Kohen gets nothing out of this whole business. You don't have to worry that maybe they got mixed around, even though it looks very peculiar, that it just worked out like that. All of the males are with all of the mothers who are not having a bechor, and all of the females. It's odd, but okay. It's odd, but that's how it is. You don't have to worry. The Gemara goes on. The Gemara comes to a conclusion lower down. Seven lines from the bottom of the page. Kol makom sheshana Rabban Shimon Gamliel l'mishnatenu. Whenever Rabban Shimon Gamliel's view is mentioned in one of our Mishnahs, halacha kamosa, the halacha is like Rabban Shimon Gamliel. So we have certain rules in the Mishnah, like we go with Rabbi Akiva, we go with Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. There are certain Tanoim who carry more halakhic authority than others. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is one of those. So we paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. What is the psak there for? What does Rabbi Shimon Gamliel hold? That we follow the majority or not?
Yes.
He says, yeah, we just assume we go with what's natural. But what's interesting here is when Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, let's look at the case again. I buy an animal who's feeding a calf, a cow and her calf, I buy from a non-Jew. The question is whether the next animal is a bechor or not. Based on our discussion on Daf Chaf that we've just had, how would Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Akiva resolve that? If we came to Rabbi Akiva, remember how we worked it at the end? So at the end we said Rabbi Akiva is the one who said, you go... Rabbi Akiva is worried about the miut, and Rabbi Yeshua is not worried about that. He says, you go after the Rav. And what is the case they're talking about? Chalof Poter. Does the presence of milk indicate that a birth has taken place?
Yes.
That's the issue. In most cases, it does. Says Rabbi Akiva, we go by says Rabbi Yeshua, we go by the most cases. Says Rabbi Akiva, no, you've got to worry about the exceptions. So if we came to Rabbi Akiva, who says we go off, you've got to worry about exceptions. Well, let's start with Rabbi Yeshua. If we go by Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Yeshua says you can follow the majority of cases, and therefore chalav poter. If the animal has milk, the next calf is not a bechor. What would Rabbi Yeshua say in this case of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, where you buy an animal and its calf from a non-Jew?
Majority is that animal belongs to its mother.
Well, we're not even interested whether that animal belongs to the mother. What are we interested in?
Is
the next right? It has milk, and it, if it has milk, then it's had a baby. Whether it's this one or another one, it doesn't really matter. We don't care. What we do care, it has had a baby, because this one isn't a bechor. It was in the hands of the non-Jew when it was born, so there's no question of bechor with this animal. What we're concerned about is next time it has a calf, is that going to belong to the Kohen? So Rabbi Yeshua would say, absolutely not. There was milk, and Rabbi Akiva would say,
you have to
be concerned.
He would be concerned. The milk isn't enough of a proof. But here, there's another issue. The issue is here, it's not just milk. She's actually suckling a calf.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, it's not just we see milk and we don't see a calf. And we've got to speculate, maybe she's given birth somewhere. We don't know where the calf is. Here we actually see the calf. So Rabbi Akiva, we're not sure how Rabbi Akiva would hold here, because this case is a little more complicated. But for sure, Rabbi Yeshua would hold, next animal is not a bechor. Isn't that right? And the reason, if we would say Rabbi Yeshua, why? Why is the next animal not a bechor?
Well,
there was milk.
There was milk. What does Rabbi Shimon Gamliel say?
Something different.
Well, the halacha is the same, isn't that right? He says, yeah, the next animal is not a bechor, but the reason...
The situation's different, though. We have these animals that they may be suckling, but that doesn't usually happen, he's saying. You don't have to worry about that. But what about the issue of chalav poter? He didn't really...
He doesn't even mention the issue of chalav poter.
Yeah.
Which would seem to indicate that he doesn't agree with Rabbi Yeshua on the issue of chalav poter. Got it? If he held like Rabbi Yeshua on chalav poter, he would not have to go into the whole question of it's natural for a cow to suckle her own calf. Wouldn't be, it would be irrelevant. Who cares? What we care about is there's milk. If there's milk, there's been a baby. So clearly he says having milk alone is not enough. That doesn't prove anything. That's Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. What does the Gemara say at the bottom?
We follow
Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So therefore, based on the Gemara and Daf Chaf Dalet, how should we paskin in the Gemara and Daf Chaf?
Like Rabbi Akiva.
Like the revised Rabbi Akiva. So now we can start the Tosfos. Now you'll see, once you've done the preparation, the Tosfos is much easier. Chalav Poter Ika Benaya. So you can use the square print version that I printed out, or you can use the Tosfos inside. Posak Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam made a halachic determination here. The cholov eino poter, that milk is not evidence that a birth has taken place. He paskins like Rabbi Akiva revised. Why? Delekaman befirkin meskinan k'Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Because further on in Daf Chav Dalet, we paskin like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. The Omar who said, "Belokeach behema mini kama ovid kechavim." If you buy a feeding cow from a non-Jew, dipeturo mina bechoro. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says the next animal is not a bechor. De lo merachma ela im kein yalda, because a cow doesn't feed a calf unless it is her own calf. Aval mitam chalav lechud lo miftura, but he says nothing about milk being the cause of the ptur. He loved the ik of lad bahada. It's only because there's a calf with the animal. There, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, that proves to us that this must be her calf and the next animal is not a bechor. But if I didn't have a calf next to her, even if she were giving milk, I would not make that assumption. The chazina de merachma leo minikato, we see that she's actually feeding this calf, and therefore we can assume that the next calf won't be a bechor, but not because of chalav poter. He has a beautiful example how Rabbeinu Tam takes this Gemara. We have a halachic confusion because you've got Rabbi Akiva versus Rabbi Yeshua, and you've got, it's all very confusing. And he takes a step back and he says, but if you read on, when you come to Daf Chaf Dalet, it's clear that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel holds like Rabbi Akiva here, and we paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So that the halacha is that we paskin like Rabbi Akiva, that chalav eino poter. Now, what's important about all this is not so much, it's unlikely that you're going to have a case of a cow is giving milk and a bechor and a koyin. It's unlikely that any of us are going to encounter that exact situation. That's not what's important here. That's also important, but there are other more important things here. Umitoch kach, let's go further. And as a result of that, medakdek Rabbeinu Tam, dehachi hilchata, that's how Rabbeinu Tam worked out that this is the halacha. Not everybody agrees with Rabbeinu Tam, by the way, but that's how Rabbeinu Tam learns it. And here says Tosfos, so you've got to explain it. So what's happened? Does that mean that we follow the minority? We know that's not true. We know we don't follow the minority. And Rabbeinu Tam is saying it's a great example of this, the mathematics of Gemara conflicting with kind of the common sense of Gemara. And how do you deal with that? Common sense is we know we follow majorities. But if you follow this mathematically, as Rabbeinu Tam has just done, he's just taken us through a beautiful piece of mathematical reasoning. You look at the fact, he did it because of this reason, not because of that reason. You come back to our case here, and therefore it must be. So mathematically, it all makes sense. Absolutely, Rabbeinu Tam is 100% right. But that means we worry about minorities. You can't live like that. How do we live like that? Where does that leave us? So we don't just abandon the common sense, nor do we abandon the mathematical reason. We have to reconcile them. And this is how he reconciles them. De chayshina limi uta hecha deika chazaka bahade. When there is a minority plus a chazaka, then we follow the minority. So now we're introducing a new element of dealing with doubt. The one is rov and miut, which we've dealt with, majorities and minorities, and we've talked about a ruba de ita kaman and a ruba de leta kaman, statistical data and statistical norms, and we've talked about the difference between these. Now we have a new idea called a chazoka. And there are many different kinds of chazoka, but the simple chazoka that we're dealing with here is status quo. The halacha puts a lot of value to the status quo. You need a lot of convincing to change a status quo. And our assumption is the status quo is in place unless you've got good evidence that it isn't. And I always give the example, if I were to come to you after you daven Ma'ariv and I would say to you, did you say Kaddish tonight? And you would say, no, why would I be saying Kaddish? I would say, have you checked up at home? Do you know that you haven't lost somebody since last you spoke to somebody at home? Are you sure? Maybe you should be saying Kaddish. We would go crazy. We have a chazaka. When I was last at home, everybody was good and happy and well, and I can assume that you can make that assumption even if, God forbid, somebody's busy dying at home. Until you hear that they've passed away, they're alive. you live with the status quo until you have evidence against that. That's the power of a chazaka. Says Tosfos, what by with Rabbeinu Tam's reasoning, it doesn't mean that you follow minorities. That's not what Rabbeinu Tam is saying. Rabbeinu Tam is saying if there's a minority that supports a chazaka, then you follow the minority plus the chazaka. What's the chazaka here? He tells us in the next words, ki hacha, like in our case, shehi bechezkat shelo yalada. The animal starts off being in a situation, chalav poti, you've got an animal, you don't know whether it's had a baby or not. What's the status quo?
No baby.
No baby. You're not aware of it ever having had a baby. So the status quo is no baby. And now, you've got, but she's giving milk. And most animals, if they give milk, have had babies. Yes, but there's a mi'ut that supports the status quo. Right? There's a minority of cases that supports the status quo. And that we can put together. So the mi'ut and the chazaka come together. That's what Rabbeinu Tam works out from this Gemara. It's not just do you follow the majority, do you follow the minority? Not so simple. No, we know you follow the majority. But here we see, learning it mathematically, we're worrying about the minority. Says Tosfos, because supporting the minority is a status quo, there's a chazaka, and that's very powerful. We won't use a majority to undo a status quo plus a minority. Very important principle of life, by the way. You can think of thousands of cases where that is. Do you just follow the majority? Yes, unless there's a status quo. You don't follow them. You don't follow the majority if the minority supports a status quo. A majority doesn't always change the status quo.
That's a very anti-revolutionary idea, right?
Yes, totally anti-revolutionary.
Revolutionaries wouldn't happen. There's a status quo.
And what a world! What a great world it would be.
You've got all your rhetoric and everything, but
yeah, but it's got to. Hey, you can have debate, because they still don't forget the case of the judges. Where we do Acharei Rabin Lahatot, therefore we follow a majority. And this gets very, very complicated. You begin to see the complexity of Psak Halacha. That's where I giggle when people, ordinary people like us, make comments of the Halacha should be this. This should be kosher. You should be allowed to do this. One should be allowed to do this on Shabbos. What do you know? What are you talking about? Do you understand Rov and Chazokah? And do you know how to work with it? And when you put a miut with Chazokah and when you don't? That's what Halachic reasoning is. We are so ignorant, we're not in any kind of position to pass any kind of opinion as to what should or shouldn't be allowed, unless you've studied it as we're studying this piece of Gemara. Now Tosfos goes on, Va'afilu lo kaimelan k'Rabbi Meir. Even though we do not hold like Rabbi Meir, who generally follows the minority. Rabbi Meir used to be very nervous about any possibility of something being wrong. De metaher b'hayi derov tinokot metapchim. There is a case in Nida of a piece of dough which challah has been taken from. It needs to be used for the Kohanim, but a baby is playing with it. And we can assume that the baby has been playing around all over the place and is probably not tahor. Because most babies play around with things and they pick up little dead insects and things like that, and then they're not tahor, and then they touch the dough, and then the dough is not tahor, and then a kohen can't have it, and so on. But Rabbi Meir says, I'm not worried about that. Rabbi Meir doesn't only use it l'chumra. He says, mitam smoch mi'uta l'chazot. Sorry, he says, Rabbi Meir, I'm not worried. Why? Because, yes, most babies play around, but some babies don't. And maybe this baby didn't. And the dough was in a state of tahor, and therefore he allows it. There Rabbi Meir uses miut plus chazoka to be makel, to allow the dough to the kohen. We don't go along with that. We go lahachmir. So Rabbi Meir is consistent. He always follows the miut. Whether it's lahachmir or it's lahakel, he'll always be worried about an exception. We don't. We generally follow the majority, unless the minority has a chazoka, and we're going to be machmir. So now there's another condition. So you've got a minority, plus a chazoka, and it's lechumra. Then we put all that together, and then we're concerned about that. Ve'afal gav de'fer kama de'chulin mashma de'ein halacha k'Rabbi Meir. This is a very important piece for our sanity. Because in Chulin we see the halacha is not like Rabbi Meir. Afilu lahachmir, even lahachmir. Dikomar, because the Gemara says there, the Rabbi Meir dechayish lemiuta, hechi achil bisra. According to Rabbi Meir, who's worried about every slight possibility, even if it's a minority of cases, how can he ever eat meat? How can anything be kosher? And the reason there that they're concerned about it is, why not? The animal's shechted by, let's say Rabbi Meir checks the knife himself and he examines the shechet, and the shechet is a Talmid Chochem and a Tzaddik, and the shechet, and he watches the shechita, and everything's fine. Still there's a problem. Maybe at the place where the knife cut the trachea and the esophagus of the animal, maybe there was a trefa, maybe there was something there that would have rendered the animal a trefa, that there could have been a disease on that part of the trachea or the esophagus that from which the animal might have died, even without shechita ultimately, and therefore the shechita isn't, the animal is trefa, was trefa before it was even shechita. And you wouldn't know because the animal's been shechted, or you can't see if there was a disease there. But most animals don't have a disease in exactly that place where you shecht. That's a very unlikely possibility. But Rabbi Meir is worried about unlikely possibilities. So the Gemara says, how does Rabbi Meir ever eat meat? Now look what the Tosfos notices, that the Gemara says, "Demashma de'ein halacha kein." From that question, you know that the halacha is not like Rabbi Meir. Deloka amar hechi achlinan bisra. The question is not how do we eat meat. That's not what the Gemara says. It says hecha achil. How does he eat meat? We can eat meat because we follow the majority. But poor Rabbi Meir, who follows the minority, how can he ever eat meat? So from the grammar of the question, we see the halacha is not like Rabbi Meir. So now we know we don't follow even lahachmi. We don't follow Rabbi Meir. Mikol makom, nevertheless, heched des chazoka mesayato chayshinan. When there is a chazoka with the minority of cases, we do worry. Status quo with the minority, lahachmir. V'hacha ike chazoka dehamed behema becheskat shelo yalada. Usmoch miutze decholvus v'afapi she'en yoldus lechazoka. Here we have a minority of animals can give birth. A minority of animals can give milk even if they haven't given birth. There is also an assumption this animal has not yet given birth. Take that assumption this animal has never given birth. With the minority of animals that even though they're giving milk, they have not given birth, put the two together, lahachmir, and we can't be sure that the next animal is not a bechor. He's at least a sophic bechor. The animal is at least a bechor in doubt. That's the piece of Tosfos that I want to do. I want to add one little piece for those who still with it, which is an interesting chazaka that we have. It comes a little bit further into this. We're not going to do it. An animal is shechted, and there's doubt whether the shechita is a good shechita or not. Is there a chazaka at play? Just a regular healthy animal. Good animal is shechted. Is there a chazaka at play? In that, so the rabbi gets the question now. Here was this animal, the shochet shechted it, and the shochet is not 100% sure that the way he did it was absolutely right. It's possible he made an error as he was shechting the animal. He just doesn't know. So the rabbi has now got to look at all the different things. Look at Rav and look at Chazok. Are there any Chazokas at play?
Most of his animals that he shechts are...
That's a rov. That would be a rov. So the rov is generally when a shochet is an experienced shochet and he shechts most of his shechits. There's a miut, there's a minority that aren't. So is there a chazaka? What is the status of the animal before it shechted?
Alive.
And therefore?
And so therefore.
Can stay alive. You think it's going to stay alive for a year.
And therefore treif. Can't be eaten. Shechita changes the status of an animal from a living animal to an animal that may be eaten. So there is a chazoka. With every shechita, there is a chazoka. If you're in doubt, well, the last we knew this animal, you couldn't eat it. Mm-hmm. Now, the only thing that makes it edible is a shechita, but if you're not sure if it was a shechita or not, you can't change the status quo.
Something sounds fishy about that.
Why?
I'm trying to put my finger on it. Something sounds funny because it's a whole different... the live animal that you can't eat is only potentially edible were it shepherded properly.
You've never heard about of sushi and you know, live eating foods, lobsters and things?
We talk about a species where you can only... It's only kosher if it's shechted properly.
Yeah, it's only kosher. That's the whole point. But it doesn't mean you can't eat it. That's why there's an issur of eva menachai. So theoretically, you could chop a piece off of it while it's still alive. But you're not allowed to. Why not?
But the only population you're trying to get the kazaka from is of the animals that were shechted and are now dead, will the animal, upon investigation, turn out to be one that you can eat or not? The transition to live to dead doesn't feel right to me that's...
So an animal is a
piece... I wish I was saying this right.
An animal is a piece of... I know this is not very politically correct today. An animal is a living piece of meat. I'm talking about domestic animal, a cattle. It's a living piece of meat. And what makes it edible, what makes it permissible, is the act of shechita. That's what turns it from meat that cannot be eaten. So it's not that it's alive and now it's dead. That's not the important thing, because if an animal's dead, it's an avela. Can't eat it. Doesn't help that it's no longer alive. It's not alive to dead that makes it edible. It's shechita. It's the act of shechita makes it. Until there's an act of shechita, the animal may not be eaten. So we regard the animal prior to shechita as not being not edible, and therefore, if the shechita is in doubt, we say, there's a chazoka. So, and you want to change the status of the animal from treif to kosher, and you don't have a definite act of shechita, we can't do that. Bearing that in mind, think of the case of Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir says, what is Rabbi Meir's case there? Maybe there was a disease on the point where the knife cut the esophagus and the trachea, maybe there was a disease there, and therefore the shechita wasn't a good shechita. And says Rabbi Meir, but it's okay. There's a miut. That's a miut. It's an unlikely case, and therefore we'll go with the miut. What about the chazoka? The fact is, the chazoka is the status quo. This animal was not able to be eaten. How can you follow a miut against that chazoka? So I just want to introduce you to the idea that in the shechita there are two different things, and this might be a little bit of what you're getting today, but there are two different things at play. There are two different dinim. One is nevelo and one is trefa. Nevelo means an animal that wasn't shechted or wasn't shechted properly. A dead animal is a nevela. It's not treif. A dead animal is not treif. A dead animal is nevela. And dead means it didn't have a proper shechita. Then it's a dead animal. If it had a proper shechita, then it's boso, then it's meat. That's different. It's not a nevela. Trefa is an animal that had a disease from which it could die. We discussed that a few weeks ago, what a treif is. A treif is, you know that the animal can be treif before it dies. We just don't know that until we open it up and check its lungs and its intestines and so on. We don't know that it was a treif, but it could have been a treif before. What the Maharsho explains here is actually very brilliant. And the Maharsho says, as far as whether or not this animal was an avela or not, there is a chazoka. Isn't that so? It was, before it was shechted, it was not able to be eaten. It needed shechita. So on that, there is a chazoka. But here we're not talking about whether, the problem here is not whether the animal is an avela or not. The shechita was a good shechita. The question is, was it a trefa or not? On it being a trefa, we don't have a chazoka. Do you follow? Because you've got to be able to think along both tracks. The shechita makes it no longer an avela. And therefore one can eat it. The checking that the shofar does, there are two very important parts of the shechita process. The one is the actual slaughtering, and there is the checking of the animal after the slaughtering, where the shofar puts his hands inside the cavity of the animal and checks for diseases, particularly lung diseases, but not only lung diseases. Any of the diseases that are frequent and could cause the animal to be treif. And these two activities actually permit the animal from two different isurim. The shechita means the animal is not an avela. The checking means the animal wasn't a trefa. That's what we want to find. In the case of Rabbi Meir, the sofek is about the shechita. So that's in the track of nevela. The sofek was not about the shechita. The shechita was a great shechita. The sofek is in the area of trefa. Was this animal diseased or not? Is there a chazaka as far as the disease is concerned? No, there's no previous assumption that the animal was diseased. We don't have such an assumption. So you can ignore the chazaka that you can't eat the animal until it's shechted, because that's not the sofik. So when we say you connect a mi'ut to a chazaka, the mi'ut and the chazaka must both be in the very area of the sofik, of the doubt. It can't be in some related area.
But if his worry had been that he didn't sever the right...
Yes,
cord,
that would be...
Then
that
we
would
exactly. worry about that.
Yes, there you would have the chazaka.
Yeah.
Because the sofik is the shchita, not the trefa. So you've got to check this to begin to see how complicated psak halacha becomes. And this is in all areas of halacha. Hilchos Shabbos and Hilchos Kashrus and Hilchos Nidah. All of them, you're dealing with these kinds of complexities with shaylas. Is it... What exactly is the sofik? In what area of halacha is the sofik? Within that very area, do we have rov, do we have chazaka? What kind of chazaka is it? What kind of rov? Is there a miut that you can attach to a rov? If so, is it lachmir or is it lahakel? Those are the kinds of things that we have to work on in order to resolve a halachic shayla. Nowadays, people look on Google to resolve a shayla. This is the level of complexity that a shayla
is. I have a question, maybe you don't know, but how is it?